has ceased fire. We're being held in a tractor beam.
We're being pulled inside, Commodore. You must veer off.
Maintain phaser fire, helmsman.
We have lost warp power. If we don't break the tractor beam within 60 seconds, we never will.
But don't you understand? We've got to destroy it!
That, sir, is illogical. It is suicide. Attempted suicide would be proof that you are psychologically unfit for command. If you don't veer off, I shall relieve you on that basis.
Veer off!
Emergency impulse power.
We can't break loose.
We need more power.
We haven't got it. We're being pulled inside.
Thank you once again for downloading Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm the host, Terry DeFellin, and I'm joined by Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And Derek Mantle.
Hello.
This edition of Whom Pods Destroy is going to be about the episode called The Doomsday Machine from the second season of Star Trek, the original series. And this is an episode well known to all Star Trek fans, unless you are someone who doesn't know it. If you're a fan of TNG or DS9, Voyager, you don't get involved in TOS much, then you need to stop and go and watch it, because this has plenty of spoilers in it, this episode. That's how we roll. We assume that everyone's already seen these episodes. The Doomsday Machine, this is the story of the Planet Killer. In fact, it was originally called by the author, Norman Spinrad, of this episode, The Planet Killer. That's how it was originally going to be called. And it's the story of the USS Constellation, which encounters a giant robotic ship with an enormous maw, conical in shape, with an enormous maw that literally destroys worlds and makes short work of the USS Constellation. Matt Decker is the only survivor from the attack and is left alone, isolated on his beaten ship, and is discovered by the USS Enterprise. And so they work to find, track down the killer and ultimately neutralise it. And in the end, Matt Decker has to, or feels it necessary, to sacrifice his life in order to help neutralise and destroy this machine, which is very sad, very poignant, very interesting, and I guess quite dark themes going on here with this.
Mm. Well, literally dark things, because a lot of the sets are obviously
quite dark.
Well, they a lot of it takes place on an identical ship to the Enterprise.
Mm. And it's another Constitution class,
and it's done really, really well.
Yeah,
because the use of lighting there to make you feel that you're in a damaged version. If this was done today, they'll put a blue filter or something like that on it to make it look like to make viewers know that they're on the different ship. But in this one, they just use different lighting. Use of shadows in this is really, really, really clever.
Apparently, it's the first example of the redressed of the new Enterprise engine room. The Enterprise engine room changes.
and Horter eggs all around it.
And Horter eggs. I saw that. I don't know whether you noticed
that. No, I didn't notice.
I was watching that and I thought, is that a Horter egg? Oh, look, there's another one there.
There's three Horter eggs, isn't
there? There you go. Maybe they recruited some Horters and were waiting for them
to
hatch.
Just dropping eggs.
Derek, it's an interesting way to redress that with the cables going on there and the lighting.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of this sort of stuff in. It's the alternative Enterprise, really, is what you're seeing.
Yeah.
You know, as well as being, it is another ship, but what you're seeing is like some of the really good episodes where you're comparing and contrasting to what the Enterprise is doing to another ship or to another captain, to another crew, and so on, which is really, you know, it's like, what if this was the Enterprise? And when we find out later on, Matt Decker, if that's actually Kirk.
Yeah,
what would he
have done? This is why, I mean, what happens to the Constellation is why we watch the crew of the Enterprise every week and not the crew of the Constellation, because presumably
they messed up
and Kirk never did. I remember watching this the first time I watched this, and I remember the eeriness of the familiarity of the Constellation interior. And it being so beaten up, and it was eerie and in a way slightly disturbing that you have the Enterprise, which is brightly lit, full of life,
mm-hmm.
And then you have this and it's chilling. It's like watching your as if your home was suddenly burgled or something like that. It's just a slight echo of unpleasantness. Very nicely done.
Yeah, very much as a sort of a reminder of what could happen to your own ship as well.
Yes,
to say this is the fate. This is the eventual fate of what you're going around. Yes, in.
I mean we're introduced to Matt Decker. He's in auxiliary control. He's passed out in auxiliary control. And the story goes that what he's had to do is they've encountered the planet killer. They were dead in space. He decides to beam his crew down to a planet in order to save them.
Because the ship is dead.
And then the planet killer proceeds to hit him again. They knock out his transporters. And then the planet killer destroys the planet.
Showers down on the planet.
And he has to sit there and watch it happen. Mm. And Decker's description. William Wyndham, the actor.
Mm.
It's superb.
Amazing role.
I mean, you really can identify with the awful experience it must have been. He sells it to the audience really, really well.
What attacked you?
They say there's no devil, Jim. But there is a...
Right out of hell, I saw it!
Matt, where's your crew?
On the third planet.
There is no third planet.
Don't you think I know that? There was, but not anymore. They called me, they begged me for help, 400 of them. I couldn't.
Collapses after he's just so exhausted again, and Kirk is standing over him. I looked at Kirk's reaction particularly, because it's a very touching scene. You've got McCoy on one hand, who's a doctor, who's looking at him as a doctor, and then you've got Kirk, who's looking down at him as someone who frankly thinks this could totally be me, and maybe one day it will be me. Because I mean, the guy's made a call. It may not have been the right call, but who's to say whether or not Kirk would have made a similar call, or what he would have done. But he knows he's looking at some of the, I think he's thinking, this could be me one day. And you've got Washburn and Scotty actually in the background, looking onwards in a degree of sympathy and reverence. I mean, they should be working, but they're not. They're bearing witness to the end of a great man. And one assumes he's risen to the rank of Commodore, he's a commander of a starship. You know, and it's a very lovely scene. You have to give credit to the director and to the cinematographer to creating this very wonderful, moody kind of scene, and indeed the composer. And I think that these are the moments that really elevate this particular episode and make it a quality work, because there are difficult themes. It's a story about a weapon of mass destruction. It's a story about the consequences of war and the consequences of leadership.
It's also about revenge. Obviously, there's the other aspect to it.
Norman Spinrad is the writer, and he has subsequently said that there is an element of Ahab, and there was an element of Ahab in Decker. Well, the actor had no idea that this was the case, and when he was told years later that that was the case, he went, oh, I would have done it differently if I'd known that.
But he does it perfectly. Yeah. I mean, he does it. Yeah. He delivers a really, really good performance there.
Yeah.
Considering that, you know, he's just turned up there and just basically given a script and gone on with it.
Yeah. Because I mean, obviously, he thought it was just a silly science fiction show.
Yeah. but it turns up and does it and does it great. I mean, he's been in Twilight Zone episodes as well, so he's got that sort of background of it. Yeah.
He does a really good job on that episode.
No, he does put a lot of he really does his acting chops.
Yeah.
But
he's got that whole sweaty look about him. And the 5 o'clock shadow as well, and so you can see he's a bit rough around the edges, but you do get glimpses of him doing what Kirk does, and the way he does it, and I think it's little bits that I only picked up on when I watched it again, was the fact that when the Enterprise is attacked, Decker's the first one on the helm.
Yeah.
The first one to recover and actually sorting things out again.
Yeah, which is a totally a Kirk thing that would happen.
Yeah.
Whenever that happens in other episodes, Kirk's usually the guy who gets to the helm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Sulu is it's his actions that when the Constellation breaks the tractor beam on the Enterprise.
Yes.
It's his actions that make sure that the Constellation doesn't get
that's right.
straight away. And then he gets everyone back again. And
he wins them back.
Can see the glimpses of the fact that now this guy isn't just some dick from Starfleet. This guy is actually the equal of Kirk. He's made a mistake and he's a bit messed up now. Yeah. But
he probably shouldn't be commanding.
No.
But you can see why
exactly. he is. The whole thing that McCoy says, oh, I haven't had a chance to do it. Yeah, is wrong because...
That was a MacGuffin. He was on his way for a medical examination. He should have pointed it out. He obviously completely forgot about
that. Yeah, of course. So it is a MacGuffin. But, you know, we can accept it because it tells a story.
It tells a great story.
Yeah.
And it tells a story about Spock as well, doesn't it? And just what an absolute slave he is to the system. Because, I mean, really... You know, he could, I think if you're sitting in that chair, you don't get out of that chair if you really don't think that the guy there is it. I mean, like, no one on that ship is going to go to the Decker's aid and say, look, you need to get out because this guy who's just destroyed his own ship needs to come destroy it. Unless
you've got the conceit enough to believe that you can control him even though he's sat in the chair.
Well, we had a conversation about Spock and the influence that he has on his commanding officers, which we will say for another time.
Yeah.
But that is an interesting point that maybe he felt that he can, you know, he can temper his worst excesses by remaining within the chain of command. You were going to say something?
Well, I was going to say it's quite interesting on the deck of the Enterprise after Decker's got, you know, is there while Kirk is back on the Constellation, is that it's chocker full of people. We've got those two security guards that are by the turbo shaft, and then you've also got a new communications officer.
Yeah, no Uhura in this episode. Uhura,
you know, and
Palmer, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. And you've got two technicians helping her fix the to try to figure out.
And then you've also got Sulu there, who's just sitting there going, looking back, what did I do? What did I do? What did I do? Who shall I listen to? You know, and it's like,
but that helps bring out the sort of the tension of because it suddenly becomes a very very busy.
Yeah.
But also as well, it shows another difference between the Enterprise and the Constellation, about how lonely they are over on the Constellation and how busy and full of life it is over on the Enterprise.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, as well, because they're using the auxiliary bridge as well, you've got a smaller bridge, more claustrophobic area as well.
Yes.
A great episode as well for Kirk getting his hands dirty as well.
Yeah, he does some work, actually.
And he's getting a bit peeved off with Scotty and other people not doing their fair share.
Yeah, he's hassling them, isn't he? Yeah. But I mean, he knows what's at stake.
Yeah.
And he's really, really pushing them. I mean, props to Jimmy Doohan for this episode because he's this and the one we discussed last week
as well. True, that actually. Two really, really good.
Well, I was going to bring up that because the thing is that Scotty, when he was on in A Taste of Armageddon, he actually was more proactive on the on the deck when he was told to do things, and he basically, you know, goes against the Fox.
Yeah, of course.
He?
We didn't mention that in the last episode.
And the thing is that in this time, you've got Spock who's not doing... He's basically just following the lines. Yeah. Doing everything that he's been told from
Spock's Decker. Situation is somewhat different.
It's different.
Because Decker is a superior officer in Starfleet.
Yeah.
And so he's got the authority, whereas Fox is not a starship commander.
Spock could also be projecting what a Vulcan would do in that situation. Yeah. Even if you had lost all your crew, you'd get on with it, wouldn't you?
Yeah, conceivably. Yeah, so, no, he might maybe.
There is something like that. So these are arguments that you can put on that.
But it's that little dynamic in the episode is, and that's a lovely little, it's a lovely little trope. It's a lovely little trope. Yeah. Sorry, I sound like Harry Redknapp there, don't I? the older, weaker, vulnerable commander and the more able second in command. It's a bit run silent, run deep. It's a bit Star Trek motion picture, isn't it?
Well, of course, and it's Decker's son, of course.
Yes, this is never said on screen.
No.
But Roddenberry's adaptation of his novelization of the motion picture.
It's never mentioned.
It's never mentioned. Oh. But it is in Roddenberry's novelization of the motion picture.
Maybe that's where
that
I read
Matt
it.
Decker is yeah. Will Decker's
father. I
think
father. It's referred to in virtually everything, every other reference.
Yes. Yeah. And so it's canon that this is indeed the case. And it's quite interesting. Yeah, so there's an interesting parallel there where you've got Spock, mm-hmm. who is, and to a lesser extent McCoy, who are challenging Decker's authority when he takes over the Enterprise. And then spool forward, well, actually about 10, 11 years later, and it's Will Decker, his son, challenging Kirk, Admiral Kirk, as he usurps his command. Some interesting parallels, unexpected parallels to be drawn there. And also, in fairness, you've got the big, bad machine that's destroys worlds also. Yeah. Although obviously the solution to the motion picture is somewhat different.
Yeah, well, the themes are there are very much motion picture, but there's also themes from Wrath of Khan as well, with the sort of Ahab and Moby Dick things as well.
Yeah, and also the planet. The thing is that when
left marooned
on SETI Alpha 5. Yeah.
This is SETI Alpha
5. This is SETI Alpha 5! Sorry.
Yeah.
The more I think about this episode, the more it's about Matt Decker, isn't it? This is actually, he's the star of the show. Yeah. He's the main character in this show.
Mm. You don't think SETI Alpha 6 was destroyed by the Planet Killer?
It could have been.
No.
Why not?
No, we know how SETI Alpha 6 was. Don't make me recite the lines, man. Come on.
SETI
Alpha 5 exploded.
SETI Alpha 6 exploded
6 months after they were there.
Yeah.
What shot shifted up? Everything on the planet was it?
What blew it up, though? Yeah. See?
Oh, no. Right. There will be a pause in the podcast while I go.
But, yeah.
Mine.
I mean, he does have a point.
See, yeah. The thing is, surely he would have blown. You and your sizzling takes, if they. Gwen's sizzling takes. Okay, so that's possible, I suppose.
Yeah.
It could have been destroyed by the Planet Killer.
Yeah.
But why wouldn't the Planet Killer just go and destroy all the rest of the planets and set up the system?
Who knows how it works?
It
seems that the thing is that the Planet Killer goes to the most delectable planet.
It's a tasty planet.
Yes, it does just eat rocks.
It does just eat
rocks. It just eats rubble, yeah. So it wouldn't be...
Yeah, but there's still those other two planets there. Spock goes about are not habitable for humans.
That's true.
You know, and they might just give him a bit of indigestion.
And he left them behind. Maybe he doesn't like.
Yeah.
Maybe he only likes dead rubbly planets and not sort of like gas. Well, obviously, wouldn't want to eat a gas giant. I mean, they're not eatable.
Yeah.
Probably just gets rid of the life just to eat the rubble. You see, because it just scrapes it all off and goes.
So do you think it's like
taking the icing off a bun?
So
isn't
it's
it?
Not interested in the life. Maybe. It's interested in the non-life. It's just interested in the raw material.
Maybe.
There's no maybe about it, mate. This is what happened. The Planet Killer destroyed SETI Alpha 6.
Yes.
6. And you have to use the 6 whenever you're referring to SETI Alpha 6.
Yes. So there you go.
There you go.
God, that's cleared
that up. Well, that has cleared that up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Doomsday Machine's legacy is definitely assured now if it wasn't beforehand.
Yeah.
It wasn't beforehand.
I mean, I was actually going to bring up Star Trek 4 now. The
bring it.
Because the thing is that I think that...
What, the big cigar?
The big cigar.
Yeah.
This is much better than that big cigar with a piece of foil underneath it.
This is the time to talk about...
Do you know what it's made out of? In the original version? A windsock dipped in cement.
Is it really?
This is the original version of the Doomsday Machine.
The original version of a windsock dipped in cement.
Dipped in cement.
Yeah.
As I always thought, it was a bit like...
It is inspired.
Who designed it? Was it Matt Jeffries?
I would think so.
I think Matt Jeffries did everything. I think he designed everything on that.
But that's the sort of thing that he would do.
Wow. We would be helpful to find out.
And loads of lighting effects and a bit of animation in the middle there. And it was, so
this will be a chance at all time to talk about the remastered version. Yeah. Sadly, no Albert Whitlock painting to talk about, listeners. You'll be devastated to learn. But we can talk about the remastered effects. This episode is seriously remastered.
Yes.
And this is a good thing I think that you can enjoy both episodes of this.
I think so, yeah.
But have you had a chance to look? Did you have a look at the remastered?
I looked at the original, and I've seen the stills and a few of the of the remastered ones, and I can see, because there are obvious problems in the original version. Because to start with, you've got the Constellation, which isn't as good a model as the Enterprise is, because this is actually a shop-bought model.
That they've
converted.
That they distressed. Shall we say.
And it looks a bit wobbly and it's
rubbish.
It is rubbish.
When it's sitting there motionless, looks great. It's fine.
But when you're seeing the back of it, and you can see the back of the engines aren't actually. It's really, really poor.
So the remastered version is much better.
Yes.
Pitted. Real damage.
Oh, real damage.
Looks great.
Looks great. Also, the scene when the shuttle is going into the... When Decker is flying the shuttle into the...
Yeah. There's a scale issue.
There is a scale issue. But obviously, you needed to show...
You have to illustrate what's happening.
Yeah, of course. And, of course, when you're only watching it once, as people in the 60s would have been...
Yeah.
Then you... It's easy to pass that by. The video generation has come along now, and everyone's re-spooling it and watching it and everything, and saying how ridiculous. Did it suddenly become a lot bigger, or did it shrink down?
They didn't realise that people would be recording podcasts about that episode 50 years later.
No, they didn't. They didn't. That wasn't.
They might have.
Yeah, they thought we'd be like reaching for the stars. No, yeah, we're talking about television shows from 50 years ago.
We'd all be on jetpacks by now, living full lives.
God knows what we'd be doing in 50 years' time. Hence,
So Decker's sacrificed him is not in vain. Just a quick few words finally about Decker's performance there, and Shatner's performance as well, when he's pleading with him to change his mind. We're stronger with you than without you.
Well, it's part of a fabulous performance, isn't it? Really, from Wyndham, because he really gets into it, and of course, you know. You have this bit where he's going into the moor. I don't know how it looks in the remastered one, but even in the original version, when he's going into this sort of like sparkler effect, it still has, you know, even though you can see that the effects haven't aged very well, it still looks good.
The
lighting they use, again, often huge reliance on lighting, which is done really, really well.
Yeah.
And you can imagine, like, early days of colour TV, this is really bright and...
I was actually watching the remastered, episode, and it is very enjoyable seeing all these bits and the bits. The scene there with him going in, Decker going in on the shuttle, is interesting. I haven't got the original version to compare to.
Right.
I can only do, it's like the last time I saw it was probably about two decades ago, the original one. So,
you've only got the remaster to work on.
To work on at the moment, yeah. And I did actually notice that bit when he was going into the moor of the Doomsday Machine, that they had sort of done some stuff with the lighting effects and things like that. And obviously the acting bit from the Wyndham, yeah, it's pretty good. Sort of like the way he sort of like the look of fear and the sort of going in there and the awe and stuff like that. And I thought that's actually quite a really good scene in the remastered.
Absolutely.
But I would like to go back to the old one to see the difference. Going through the whole of the remastered sort of stuff like that, it is a very good episode for the bits that they've actually put into it, and obviously the different angles of the Enterprise and the Constellation. Even though I did have a problem with some of the animation that they've done, especially the rocks and stuff, it looks a bit like Babylon 5 in some cases. I don't know when they remastered this.
These remasters are over a decade old. Yeah.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they were knocked out pretty quickly as well.
Okay.
So, it's a testimony to the show that they were prepared to spend the money and the time to remaster them. I mean, this show, 40 years old at the time, and still in syndication, and the show is still in syndication to this day, and they thought, we can remaster them because we're still going to make our money back, not just in DVD sales and Blu-ray sales, but also in syndication rights to broadcasters who still buy the show and show it on their TV sets, even now. This show still gets there. So I wouldn't be massively surprised if at some point in the future they're given another go.
Yes.
They go through it again. Oh, yeah. And remaster them again, because these stories hold up so well.
Yeah.
Largely down to the skill of the producers, the directors.
But,
the actors.
Yeah, I'm with you, Terry. Though the remastering this one works. I think it is something that works, because although I like the old version, I like the kitschiness of some of the effects. They are kitsch. They are sort of, but they are part of the experience, aren't they? Watching it. So
it's an ambitious episode. That, you know, if you forget about the remastering. But originally this was an ambitious episode. We're going to have space battles.
Yeah.
Which is expensive, and we're going to have a second ship, which also conceivably is expensive. While at the same time also being quite cheap, because it's a redress.
What Spinrad's original concept of the Planet Killer was a big arm to the teeth thing. It was like an actual spaceship,
right?
Rather than this sort of like organic
looking structure.
Yeah.
Oh right. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So, a few words about Norman Spinrad, shall we? Okay. Interesting guy.
Yes.
I mean, you were telling me just now he was in his early 20s when he wrote
The
Doomsday Machine. Yeah. And he's a full credit for this episode, written by Norman Spinrad. So no Gene Coon, no doubt rewritten.
Yeah.
All episodes are rewritten of TV shows. Yeah. But I mean, to hold us the solo credit for this suggests that much of what he had in this was in there. An anarcho-syndicalist. A very much left wing. Early in his career, and it didn't become apparent about his political views until later on in his career. Mm. You were telling me this before, weren't you, Graham? But an interesting guy in there, and very much part of the sci-fi new wave of sci-fi writers from the mid 1960s, and he features prominently amongst those guys like Robert Bloch. Philip Jose Farmer, Harlan Ellison, Theodore Sturgeon.
Yeah.
Some of these guys have written Star Trek episodes.
Yeah.
In the future, we will be doing a special episode on these writers and their other work, their non-Star Trek
work. That should be fascinating.
Which should be really interesting.
Yeah.
But it really puts Star Trek in amongst that, in that new wave. And that I think is another part of its appeal, perhaps more to a people of a hipster bent. That Star Trek was very much, although it was the kind of embarrassing corporate cousin, it was very much in that new wave of sci-fi, American sci-fi.
Well, I suppose that's the thing. Oh, sorry, Derek.
I was just going to say, we always come back to, actually, the thing about these episodes of Star Trek. I mean, they are, you know, 50 to 49 years old now. Is that how good the stories are? You know, they really are excellent stories. You know, these and brilliant sort of like out there science fiction stories. You know, I mean, I know we have a couple of wobblers, but they really do.
Yeah, I mean, there is no fat on these episodes at all. I mean, we've said this before, haven't we?
With, yeah.
If some of these episodes were next gen or on, these would be two parters. If they were even more up to date, they would be. Three or four, or they would be a whole season.
Yeah, season-long arcs.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But they really pack them in.
Yeah, but the quality also shines through, this time sort of on American and British TV, science fiction stuff, the majority of American science fiction, that you had some really good stuff like The Twilight Zone and Outer Limits, but then you had all the, you know, the Irvin stuff, you know, Alan Irvin stuff.
Irvin Allen.
And, you know, they're okay. But they definitely are
rubbish.
You know, okay, they're rubbish. They're absolute rubbish.
It's box ticking sci-fi.
Yeah,
isn't that's it. Yeah, yeah. You've got your robot. You've got your space monkey. Yeah. You've got your kids.
Space monkey.
But these really do go out and try and do some excellent sort of like character studies in the human condition, don't they? And so you know.
But this is what you had with Next Gen when it first started. When you it had all the things that you thought, oh God, no, this doing all the stuff that Star Trek didn't do. It's got a kid on the bridge. It's got a robot. Yes. Oh God!
But actually, it turned out fine.
Yeah, it didn't have space monkey.
It didn't have space monkey. It held off.
Oh right, yeah. So
the climax of this episode, then, genuine tension. I think we can say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we all know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's peril, isn't it?
There is some serious peril at the end there. The 30-second countdown, we all knew, well, this isn't going to go well.
Yeah.
But in fairness, they build it up like that, don't they? Yeah. When Decker kills himself, and they realise that there's an opportunity to blow up the constellation and destroy the planet killer, and they catch the plan. And they do say, I mean, Spock and Scotty say to Kirk, look, this is a shonky transmitter, transporter, you know, you don't want to be staking your life on something like this. Yeah. And so we're all ready for the peril when it arrives. Yeah,
you can talk more about this, Terry, but the music in this episode is amazing.
Yes.
It absolutely is.
Yes, and it comes up there. And this episode has an original score.
Yeah,
As I may have mentioned before, only just over 35% of the original series of Star Trek had original scores. The rest of it was done on what they call tracked. And so they used existing scores and put it up there. The Doomsday Machine had original score commissioned for it, and it was composed by Sol Kaplan. So almost all of it. There's a few things that are tracked from earlier episodes because I know these things. but almost all the rest of it is an original score, and then consequently appears and is heard many times over throughout the rest of the second series.
Because it's so good, and it works so well, and that's what helps with that tension and helps with the peril.
Yes, and you've got the whole do, which is always a good thing that you want to have when you've got big giant killers, planet killers coming towards you, that ratcheting it up the tension, the ticking, the countdown. I'm sure there was a ticking. Sure they actually had a ticking going on there, which I don't know whether that was sound effect or whether that was the original score. I think that was sound effect, they worked that in really, really well.
Yeah,
and the whole countdown scene is good with Scotty get up and down the Jefferies tube, trying to make it look like he's doing something.
Yeah,
Spock's voiceover telling him to get a move on. You know, in a kind of Mr. Scott, you know, really slowing it down. I'm not stressed. No, I'm a Vulcan. Yeah. Vulcans don't feel stressed.
The slow countdown as well, isn't it? It's 14, yes. 13, 12,
and Sulu, which is a nice callback to the call mic manoeuvre when even starting a countdown, with Sulu and his countdowns, and the coolest guy in the whole scenario is Kirk, who's just standing there with his communicator, thinking, "There's nothing more I can do now."
Yeah, still holding his communicator when he tries.
Also, he's got his sexy top on,
and he has got his sexy top on. does look great. He does look great in it.
Yeah, I mean, I always wondered about that. I mean,
it's a slight variation on the first season one. The tunic is slightly. I don't know the story behind it. I think they just obviously felt that, you know, it would be nice every now and then for him to have a different tunic. And I'm all for it. He looks great in it. Shatner looks great. All iterations, even third season Shatner looks great. And as someone who's developed a similar physique, I
you cut your hair.
I admire him. Let's not be rude about the Shatner hair. He won't come on the show if we're rude about him. He's not coming on.
Right, because he'll give as good as
much better, in fact, much better. Do you guys have anything else you want to say about this episode?
I have something. I have a little point about this episode, about the story behind this episode. Apparently, Spinrad presented this story as a book and couldn't get it picked up. And I wonder how long he actually had this idea or where he got it from, because in the end of 1965, the Fantastic Four comic, issue 48, The Coming of Galactus, was released.
Yes.
So which was
Galactus trilogy.
Yes, which was about 2 years before the production of this episode. And that obviously had the planet killer Galactus in it.
And being the age that he was, Spinrad would have totally have read the Fantastic Four.
He would have totally absorbed that. And I wonder if that idea has come across
if anyone's asked him. He's still around.
Yeah.
I wonder if he was,
or whether or not he thought, hang on, that's my idea because I
he could have done.
I went to Stan Lee and go.
Maybe he pitched it to Stan
pitched
Lee.
Pitched it to him.
Or maybe he was. So can we draw? So we've drawn. This is a pivotal episode. It has ripples all the way through the franchise. We've already established that.
Yeah.
But does it also have ripples with a beyond Starship universe into the Marvel
Was it inspired by?
Yeah. But
I think it might have been inspired by, because, I mean,
I'm one of those people in the camp of Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
Doing more of the idea.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to argue with Derek about Jack Kirby.
No. I wouldn't. And no, I know it was probably his idea.
We all worship it.
Because he loved all that galactic stuff.
And yes.
He was a big science fiction reader anyway, Jack Kirby. So he,
That issue 48 is actually, probably we could talk about this afterwards, but that issue 48 is great because it finishes off the last story first. Mm-hmm. The first half of that issue is the end of the Inhumans story that they've just done.
Which is a good
story. Yeah, it's a great story as well. And it goes into the Galactus trilogy. The Galactus trilogy itself is actually two issues, but it's sort of like half of issue 48 and half of issue 50. The other half of issue 50 has the Human Torch going off to college. So it's
amazing.
Yeah, it's all like
how they used to do that.
Yeah. Soap opera.
Yeah. I don't think I've actually read that the Galactus trilogy. I know you've got it, haven't you?
I do have
you
it. Yes.
You actually own the original versions, but we won't disclose your address for fear that you will be burgled for them. Wonderful. Okay, I think we really have knocked that one out of the park.
Yeah.
And we've found some real layers to this episode, and we've also, in a perhaps the tongue-in-cheek way, we've seen, you know, the influence that it has and the role it plays, and we hope that you are enriched by our conversations, and we hope that you enjoyed it. And we'll be back again for another episode of Impos Destroy, and I would imagine that will be in a couple of weeks' time, maybe three, depending on where we are. Whompodsdestroy.com is our website address. You will find details of our Twitter handle, our email address, our Instagram, all of that, and from there you can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes and Podcatcher. If you are so minded, a favourable review would be very, very nice because it helps spread the word about this, I think, very good podcast. Thank you very much indeed for listening, and from me, Terry DeFellin, and Graham Sibley and Derek Mantle, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.